American foreign policy also hit the accelerator as the Reagan and Bush administrations mounted a series of punitive expeditions against provocative foreign regimes, from Grenada, 1983, and Libya, 1986, to Panama, 1989, and Iraq, 1990 to 1991. The embrace of high-powered automobiles, airstrikes, and invasions, all departures from the Carter mindset, drew on distinctly Republican values. The war to expel Iraq from Kuwait was oil-related, undertaken in part to protect the American lifestyle, as President George H.W. Bush acknowledged. Once military power had secured Middle Eastern oil supplies again, television news clips showed the 41st president roaring along the Maine coast at the wheel of his rakish, high-speed cigarette boat, Fidelity. The broader symbolism leaped out. Guilt complexes and hair shirts were gone, and with a Texas Republican at the helm, the United States was back to practicing gunboat diplomacy and taking what it wanted. The election of Bill Clinton in 1992 made surprisingly little difference. The sort of Bubba Democrat who had a wink in his eye and often an AstroTurf cushion in the back of his bachelor pickup truck, Clinton kept the U.S. air patrols flying over Iraq, launched occasional missile strikes, and domestically sought to make the good times roll. The auto manufacturers did their part. SUVs rolled off the production lines in steadily increasing numbers. By 1999, 48.3% of the new sales in the U.S. automobile market came from minivans, light trucks, and SUVs. Hair shirts made no comeback in 2000 either. On the contrary, Americans were driving more miles in bigger cars, living in even more remote suburbs, and, when they could afford them, buying larger, showier, gadget-stuffed houses at least twice as energy-intensive as those in Europe and Japan. In the late 90s, as the stock market bubble swelled toward its 2000 puncture, investors were especially drawn to new varieties of conspicuous consumption, backstopped by the belief that technology had initiated a new era of prosperity and U.S. supremacy. In destroying the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, Al-Qaeda struck at a nation already concerned about the economic implications of the 2000 stock market slide, and the bounce back of oil prices to the $30 per barrel range after touching lows near $10 in 1998. Under George W. Bush, petroleum and security issues become intertwined to a degree that favored the Republicans in the same way as the 1980s fatigue with Carter-type energy politics had. To a majority of the public, conservation was overshadowed by support for more two-fisted responses to the energy problem, and even activists had become reluctant to use the term because of its image as a 1970s relic. Most of all, an oil, automobile, and national security coalition had taken the driver's seat in Washington. The president and vice president came from the oil industry, and the White House chief of staff, Andrew Card, was the former president of the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. The Hydrocarbon Coalition and the 2004 election. By any serious historical standard, George W. Bush won a tight race in 2004. Yet its closeness was revealing, following an intense, if rarely candid, election year discussion of American security, including the supposed benefit of preemptive Middle Eastern invasions in preventing terror attacks and diminished lifestyles at home. Narrow margins tend to highlight polarizations. George W. Bush did not carry the states where most of the September 11th victims had lived. New York's and New Jersey's experiences with damage and death were not decisive election factors. Religious divisions, striking indeed, were more influential and will be analyzed in Part 2. Yet among the factors that had spurred the GOP electorate, a vital backdrop for the next chapter's discussion of petro-imperialism, one can discern several surprisingly influential oil, gasoline, and automobile relationships. A large number of voters work in or depend on energy and automobile industries, and still more are invested in them, not just financially, but emotionally and culturally. These secondary cadres included racing fans, hobbyists, collectors, and dedicated readers of automotive magazines, as well as the tens of millions of automobile commuters from suburbs and distant exurbs, plus the high number of drivers whose strong self-identifications with vehicle types and models serve as thinly disguised political statements.